Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and President Obama is about 1 hour into a town hall meeting at Portsmouth High School in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. It's a lot tamer than the town hall meetings we've been hearing in recent weeks, which reportedly prompted the White House to send the president out on the road starting today in Portsmouth. Let's listen first to some excerpts. Here's a portion from Obama's opening remarks.
Let me just start by setting the record straight on a few things I've been hearing out here about reform. Under the reform we're proposing, if you like your doctor, you can keep your doctor. If you like your health care plan, you can keep your health care plan. You will not be waiting in any lines. This is not about putting the government in charge of your health insurance. I don't believe anyone should be in charge of your health insurance decisions but you and your doctor. I don't think government bureaucrats should be meddling, but I also don't think insurance company bureaucrats should be meddling. That's the health care system I believe in.
The president then responded to questions, including one from a young girl who asked him about what she said were all the signs she saw outside that she said mean things. Well, the president tried to explain why some had inaccurately said there would be death panels in the new bills.
The rumor that's been circulating a lot lately is this idea that somehow the House of Representatives voted for death panels that will basically pull the plug on grandma because we've decided that it's too expensive to let her live anymore. And there are various, there are some variations on this theme. It turns out that I guess this arose out of a provision in one of the House bills that allowed Medicare to reimburse people for consultations about end-of-life care, setting up living wills, the availability of hospice, et cetera. So the intention of the members of Congress was to give people more information so that they could handle issues of end-of-life care when they're ready on their own terms. It wasn't forcing anybody to do anything. This is, I guess, where the rumor came from.
Some other points from the president's town hall meeting still ongoing. He said he was against a single-payer system, a sort of Medicare for everyone. Instead, he was for universal health care in which everyone would be insured, with private companies working alongside the government to do that. He said his plans would offer, or rather the congressional plans which he backs, would offer more choice, would cost less. And in response to another question, he said he was for more mental health coverage. Well, that's what's going on inside Portsmouth High School. Outside, boisterous crowds gathered all morning for and against health care reform. Rick Fabrizio, managing editor of the Portsmouth Herald, was there earlier today. Rick, what did you see outside?
There was an incredible number of people, I'd say several thousand people, and they were by chance, I guess, divided on either side of the road, both for and against, and I would say they equally had about the same number of people there. While it got heated at times, with shouts back and forth, for the most part, it seemed to be a very civil crowd who were just interested in getting their points across.
We talked earlier, and there are people from the AFL-CIO who are for reform. There are also people from, let's say, anti-tax groups who see a much broader criticism of Obama outside of health care. But what were some of the things you saw on the signs? We heard about the signs.
Well, on the one side, the group who would be, you know, against reform or have the most concerns with reforms, you saw some of the typical buzzwords of socialism, and a new one that I saw today of Obamianism, suggested of communism. We saw some of the concerns expressed about the so-called death squads that would rule whether or not elderly people should get the same level of services, which, of course, the president spoke to inside today. On the other side of the road, for those who were for it, there were signs that, you know, were calling for reform and a mix of those calling for a single payer system and as well of a universal system that would, you know, mirror what we see with Medicare.
Well, again, we spoke earlier today with people who said that they, in some cases, didn't even want to be inside. Nothing that they were going to hear was going to change their mind. They felt the real purpose to be there was in demonstrating. But there were Republicans inside who were asking questions of the president. One said, "I don't know what I'm doing here." And the crowd applauded him for, you know, coming. This is part of a roadshow. The president's going to be in Bozeman, Montana on Friday to talk about stopping insurers from dropping individuals who become sick. On Saturday in Grand Junction, Colorado, to talk about how he feels the plan would end high out-of-pocket costs. Your sense, just in the few seconds we have, are there minds that can be changed?
You know, at first glance, I would say no. However, I do think that this is the best thing the president can do, is to lay it out there in front of the people to decide and not rely on it being a debate in Congress. So I think there is hope, to coin a phrase, that those who are unsure can gain some level of confidence that this will lead to a reform that reduces costs and increases accessibility.
Rick Fabuzio, managing editor of the Portsmouth Herald. Rick, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, this morning in Lebanon, Pennsylvania, Senator Arlen Specter, a Democrat who recently switched from the Republican Party, faced an angry group of constituents.
One day God's going to stand before you, and he's going to judge you and the rest of your damn cronies up on the hill.
Eventually, that man left the town meeting, and Specter took questions about rumors that reform would give benefits to illegal immigrants and offer federally funded abortions. Here's one exchange.
I do not want to pay on a health care plan that includes the right for a woman to kill her unborn baby. Is it true that this plan is in the health care bill?
Well, first of all, what we are looking toward is to have both options, that if you want to have a health care plan which does not have payment for abortions, you can have that one where you'll not be charged for somebody who has an abortion. Now, if you want a different health care plan, an option where you can have payment for abortion and you pay for it because there'd be a little bigger premium, you have the choice.
Well, perhaps that needs a little more explanation, and that's what we want to do today, try to separate fact from fiction in healthcare reform. Noam Levy of the Los Angeles Times has gone through all the legislation. So, Noam, let's start with abortion. First of all, what happens currently? Does the government, through any program like Medicaid, pay for abortions?
No. There's a longstanding amendment dating back 20-plus years that prohibits Medicaid from paying for abortion.
Well, right now, Douglas Johnson, the National Right to Life Committee's legislative director, says that both Senate and House bills would create a nationwide federal insurance plan, the public option that would pay for all abortions. And you also cite a television ad from the Family Research Council that contends the same thing, that tax dollars will be used for abortions. What is the truth?
Well, it's a little more complicated, as you might imagine. It is correct that the legislation in the House and the Senate both conceive of a new government insurance program that people could access if they don't have insurance currently, and they opt for that rather than a private plan. It's also true that a number of people who go into a new insurance exchange, not unlike what you have there in Massachusetts, might select a plan, a private plan, and then get some level of federal subsidies for that new plan. Now, the question is, would those new plans, would the new government plan and would the private plans in the exchange offer an abortion services benefit? There is nothing in the legislation that says that they should. In fact, that is left up to the health commissioner and a benefits commissioner in the House bill and the HHS in the Senate bill. So that is still to be determined. Now, is it possible that some plans could offer abortion services, some of those private plans? I think it is possible.
So you're saying that someone might be part of a private plan but also receive government subsidies. So in effect, if that private plan offers abortions, you could say that some of the government subsidy would go to pay for that.
You could. Now, let me just complicate things a little bit further. There was an amendment added in the House Energy and Commerce Committee that sought to segregate the federal funding and the private funding that would go to a person's insurance policy. So it might work something like this. A woman signs up for a private plan with, let's say, Blue Cross Blue Shield, for the sake of argument. Let's say that the federal government is paying $200 out of the cost of this plan, which costs $500 a month. If there is an abortion benefit in that plan, there is a proposal that would say that only that portion of the insurance benefit that is paid by the individual, so in this case the woman's $300 contribution, could go towards giving her her abortion service, and that the $200 that the government is paying as part of that insurance premium had to be segregated so it would only pay for non-abortion services. Mm. Pretty complicated, I know.
Yeah, but it does, though, go against the claim that it's a hard and fast rule that the government is going to start paying for abortions.
There is definitely no hard and fast rule the government will pay for abortion services. And I should add one final thing, which is that this same amendment that I was just talking to you about would expressly prohibit the federal government from requiring private insurance providers from offering abortion services in order to participate in this new exchange.
So that's the abortion issue. Let's just touch on an issue we covered extensively yesterday. This is the claim that health care reform calls for euthanasia of the elderly or the disabled. Sarah Palin again saying her parents and Down syndrome child would have to go before an Obama death panel. It's blatantly untrue, but tell us a little more about the facts of the plans.
Sure. I mean, as you mentioned, I think this is really one of the most inflammatory and misleading claims about the legislation. And I guess I would leave it to others to decide whether or not this is willful ignorance or not. But there is no death panel. There's no even suggestion that the government would encourage anybody to commit suicide. What there is the following. There is a provision in the bill which would reimburse doctors for providing a consultation with senior citizens on Medicare to talk about their options for end-of-life care, such things as a living will, such things as how they should be cared for if they lose the capacity to make medical decisions for themselves. I think everybody knows somebody, maybe even has a relative, who has suffered a stroke, has become so sick that they can't make decisions for themselves anymore. And that can be a wrenching decision for relatives or other caregivers to try to determine what is the best thing to do. What this is an effort to help senior citizens plan ahead. It's optional. The senior citizens are not required to have this consultation if they don't want to. But if they want to, there's a broad range of opinion who believes that this is a good idea.
Well, as we were hearing yesterday, a lot of people have doctors who will take the time to do this, but many won't because they haven't been reimbursed for it. So this, the part of the reason that this is even in the House bill is to make sure the doctors get paid for this time.
That's right. And the idea would be that, well, if Medicare provides some incentive by paying doctors to do this, that maybe there would be more of these kinds of discussions which could be productive in the long run. I should note one final thing, which is that, you know, the AARP supports this, as does the American Medical Association. Dr. Rohack, who's the president, he called it plain old-fashioned patient-centered care, which I think captures sort of the view of many people in the medical profession about this provision.
That's Noam Levy of the Los Angeles Times helping us sort through fact and fiction in the current health care reform legislation. When we come back, we'll ask him about claims that the planned reforms would ration health care or insure all illegal immigrants. Also, later today, we'll ask, you know, can babies be taught to communicate to us when they're sick, even when they have swine flu? That's later today, back in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to Here and Now and our conversation with Noam Levy of the Los Angeles Times to find out what's actually in the health care reform legislation. Noam, let's move to claims that the current plans would ration health care. House Minority Leader John Boehner released a statement last month saying, "We don't need a government takeover of health care that raises taxes, rations care, and puts government bureaucrats in charge of decisions that should be made by families and doctors." So, does the legislation currently call for rationing care?
There is nothing in the bill that would ration care. The claim that by passing this legislation, the government will all of a sudden start telling people what treatment they can and can't get is simply false. However, this is, again, more complicated than the rhetoric suggests. There's a fair amount of quote-unquote rationing in the system right now. So what do we consider rationing? Many people probably have had the experience where they've tried to get treatment and their private insurer has said, you know, we'll pay for this, we won't pay for that. We'll pay for this drug, we won't pay for that drug. Is that a form of rationing? Maybe yes, maybe no. Will that continue? In some sense, there probably still will be private plans that are making those kinds of decisions. There is an effort in the health reform to stop private insurance companies from denying coverage to people who have pre-existing conditions, which I think could be argued will actually reduce rationing in the current system. But there also is a discussion underway to try to figure out better ways that medicine can deliver care to Americans. How can the federal government ensure that when we go to the doctor, we're getting the best care, that our doctors are up to speed on the most up-to-date research on drugs, on medical procedures, et cetera. So there is a provision in both the Senate and the House bill to create and further fund research into what's called comparative effectiveness, comparing different treatments and drugs. There is a language in the House bill that would prohibit the federal government from using that information to make coverage decisions. So, for example, if this new Institute of Comparative Effectiveness determines that pill A works better than pill B, but one is more expensive than the other, Medicare could not turn around and say, well, this is what comparative effectiveness says, we're only going to pay for the first pill and not the second pill. But now, somewhere down the road, is it possible that we could start having discussions about whether or not it makes sense for Medicare to pay for things that don't work as well? I think an honest answer would say, at some point in the future, we probably will have to have that conversation. If the legislation doesn't pass and we continue to go down the road we are right now, I think we also will probably have to have that discussion.
But that's down the road if reform doesn't work to cut costs. But right now there's a comment from Obama that's being used as proof of rationing in the current bills. A woman asked him at a town hall if her elderly mother would be denied procedures. Obama replied no. Instead, they'd be given information so that they and their doctor could decide what they wanted to do. And then he said this.
Maybe you're better off not having the surgery, but taking the painkiller.
In other words, again, the family would decide. But that comment is being aired out of context as proof that the government will order you to forego surgery for medication. So again, you say that's not true.
There's nothing in the bill right now that would mandate Medicare or any other federal program to prohibit certain medical procedures or treatment.
In fact, let's also find out what is true about people who have health care insurance and like their doctors. The president has repeatedly said if you are happy with your health care and your doctors, nothing's going to change for you under the new reform. Is that true?
The president's claim that if you like what you have, you can keep it is somewhat unrealistic. Not just because a major change in the health care marketplace is imminent, but even if nothing happens, there is no guarantee that if you like your doctor now, you can keep it. Again, I'm sure many of your listeners have found that their employer perhaps is offering them fewer choices than they once did. My employer used to offer us two health plans. Now we only have a choice of one health plan.
Yeah.
So was I able to keep what I used to have? No, I wasn't. Now, if there's a whole new insurance marketplace created, an exchange, a new government plan, is it possible that some employers will stop offering coverage or, alternatively, will they go into a new insurance exchange where there are other choices other than the ones that their employees have right now? Yes, absolutely. So does that mean necessarily that everybody will be able to keep everything that they have right now? No, I don't think they would.
Let's take a look at health care reform and immigration. The Federation for American Immigration Reform says illegal immigrants already account for $10.7 billion in state and federal health care spending, and they say that that will rise unless the health care proposals are changed to address illegal immigrants. You address another rumor that illegal immigrants will get free health care benefits. What's true?
There are express prohibitions on illegal immigrants getting health benefits, free health benefits, in the House and the Senate bills. Now, is it true that if an illegal immigrant gets in a car accident and he is brought to an emergency room, will that undocumented immigrant get care? Yes. Will that care be free? It will probably be subsidized by the federal or state government, as happens now. essentially, short of denying care to people who are very sick, there's no way to deal with that. So in the broader context of illegal immigration, the healthcare system in some ways is not all that different than other aspects of our society, that when you have people who are in this country illegally, there's a public interest in providing some services, although you could argue that that's not fair and it's not cheap.
That's Noam Levy of the Los Angeles Times, who dug deep into what is in the existing bills that are being debated in Congress. And Noam, it sort of does give a little bit of a lie to the claim that there is nothing there. There is something there. People just have to look to find it. There are some facts about what's in the health proposals.
There are indeed, and the bills are long. One of them is 1,000 pages. The other one is 600 and some odd pages, I believe. But you can find them on the Internet, and the typeface is pretty large, and so are the margins. And if anybody wants to go read them, it actually doesn't take all that much time.
Well, thank you for reading it for us, and we'll link to what you found at our website, hereandnow.org. Noam Levy, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Well, we'd love to hear your thoughts on this or any story on the program. Just go to hereandnow.org and click on Contact Us to send an email or call. Or you can scroll down and leave a comment right there on the homepage. We'd love to hear from you. Still ahead today, Vietnam-era veterans become yoga warriors. Will vets returning from Iraq and Afghanistan also give yoga a try? Back after the latest news, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. States are searching for ways to slash budgets. Here in Massachusetts, the governor cut funding for zoos. In Milwaukee County, Wisconsin, there's a proposal that would cut all county funding for paramedic services in 2010, leaving just community-funded services. And last month in California, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger eliminated the state portion of funding for domestic violence programs. Advocates say they were expecting some cuts, but not complete elimination. Over $20 million was cut. And that'll affect 94 domestic violence shelters and centers. Tara Shabazz is the executive director of the California Partnership to End Domestic Violence. It's a federally funded coalition that runs public education campaigns and lobbies in Sacramento on behalf of domestic violence centers. Tara, these centers have other funding sources, but what are you seeing happening at them because of the cuts?
Yeah, it's kind of hard to tell right now, but what we're hearing from our programs across the state, there's a possibility of definitely closing some shelters, especially in some of our rural areas. As you know, California has a lot of rural counties, and the geographic barriers for accessing the services already exist. And so having to take away a shelter from a rural community can really make it even more difficult for a woman seeking safety that may have to travel 6 or even 8 hours to get to the next shelter location. We're also seeing a drastic cutback in staffing in order to keep certain services up and running. Programs are having to cut back on how much transportation they can provide, which I believe is critical, especially when someone is trying to flee in the middle of the night to get to a shelter. We're seeing programs that may have to limit the how much 24-hour staffing that they have, which the impact that that has is that they won't be able to take as many women and children into their shelters because they won't be fully staffed.
And it's one thing that the shelters might be closing and the staffing and hotlines might be cut back, but we also understand that outreach and prevention programs are going to be cut as well?
Oh, yes, definitely. That's usually the first thing to go when there's a drastic cutback in funding. And many of these programs are supporting folks who have been exposed to violence, trying to make sure that the violence doesn't continue. And so it really takes us back. That's what one of my biggest fears is, that we'll be taken back to a place, you know, before my time where programs were operating informal safe houses and women had to go from home to home.
It's like an underground railroad almost.
Exactly. And, you know, we just really can't afford to go backwards when lives and families are at stake.
Well, Camille Hayes of your group says that if the governor thinks that this is saving money, the truth is that if you just want to talk dollars and cents, it costs more for society when you have violent relationships. But we do know that you're also lobbying a state senator, Leland Yee, who says he might be able to find funding from elsewhere. In the interim, what do you think is going to happen?
Well, you know, domestic violence is a serious public safety issue. Law enforcement, emergency rooms, and the courts will be further burdened by this cut. California very well will pay the price if this funding is not restored immediately. And so the reality is that even if the legislation does go through and funding is restored, that programs are not getting this money right now. So what that means is that someone may call a shelter and may not be able to access that shelter, and it could, they can risk their lives. We know that when a woman decides to leave an abusive relationship, that's when she is most at risk.
But will you say maybe Senator Yee might be able to, through legislation, find some of that money elsewhere and restore that $20 million. Isn't that exactly the point of budget cuts, though, that Governor Schwarzenegger is feeling he has to force the money to come from elsewhere? And if it can come from elsewhere, it means it was fat elsewhere?
Well, if it comes from elsewhere, it would only be a temporary fix. It wouldn't be permanently. So we would still need the state to have a commitment to fund this issue, as they have in the past. And so it's really about priorities. And from what I hear from the legislature is that there's a lot of support, bipartisan support for this issue, because it is a crime. And these are victims of crime, and they should be protected by the state of California.
Tara Shabazz, the executive director of the California Partnership to End Domestic Violence, speaking about Governor Schwarzenegger's recent move to eliminate state funding for domestic violence programs. Tara, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And we have a quick second here, time for a quick programming note. This week on Here and Now, we're going to learn about a program that takes Alzheimer's patients out to museums, hoping a work of art might reignite a memory. As we'll hear, it does. Also, the life of the most famous athlete you may never have heard of, something she should be as famous as Babe Ruth, Gertrude Ederle, the first woman to swim the English Channel. That's still to come this week. Still ahead today, baby signing after a short break here and now. A Scottish childcare specialist, who's also the author of a book on teaching hearing babies how to use sign language, has added a new category, signs to communicate swine flu symptoms. Yvonne Lavelle's book is Baby and Toddler Signing by KidSign. She's now added a new online e-booklet. It's called Baby Signing, Teaching Swine Flu Symptom Signs. Baby sign language has grown in popularity in the last 15 years. Our colleague Kevin says his little guys calmly sign him when they're thirsty or hungry, while his little friends can only cry in frustration. There is some criticism of baby signing, but most research shows that it does reduce frustration and tantrums, improves parent-child relationships, and that babies that can communicate have fewer behavioral problems down the road. Well, here's what baby sign sounds like. This is a YouTube video posted by a mother showing her baby daughter responding to her questions with very excited hand signals.
Dad, come on, mama. Where's mommy?
Mommy.
Excellent. What's a sign for eat? Eat. Come on, more.
More.
What we're seeing is this one-year-old put her hand to the back of her head for da-da, to the front of her head like a salute from mama for more, tapping her chubby hands together. Well, to learn more about the latest in baby sign, Yvonne Lavelle joins us from Glasgow. Yvonne, just tell us a little bit more about baby sign language.
Well, baby sign language is really derived from American Sign Language, or in this country, British Sign Language. And what we do is we use the simple signs from the language and teach it to young babies, probably over about 5 months old, up to, you know, preschool.
Well, we understand it was an interpreter, actually, Joseph Garcia, in 1986, who realized that hearing babies and toddlers were picking up his deaf signs. And then this has also been studied at the University of California, Davis. And so, you know, people have been doing this. What kinds of signs had you been working with infants?
Well, generally, you would really want to teach eat and more and milk and, you know, all the food signs, and then maybe move on after that to other subjects.
Well, we heard some of the signs, but what would, for instance, would be more if an infant wants more to eat?
Say, for instance, you're in the situation where you're feeding your child, so you're doing the sign for eat, which is bunched hand up to the mouth, eat, and then if the child wants more, then before you feed the child again, you would do the sign more and then feed them more food. And the baby would pick up that you're actually giving them something else. So they start to accept the concept that you're doing this symbol every time you feed them, you know. So they start to pick it up, and after a few weeks, they want to do that sign to you to say more. So So.
And that sign is tapping fingertips together a few times, kind of bunching their fingertips together. That means more.
That means more. A baby could maybe reciprocate the sign in a more simpler way.
Well, we know you already had a sign for unwell, ill or unwell, sort of a touching head and stomach at the same time. But what are the swine flu signs?
Yeah, well, swine flu signs, you're obviously wanting to teach your babies or young children the signs for hot, also the signs for cold, because if you've got the flu, you can be chilly as well. So you would like to teach hot, cold, water, more water, possibly pain as well, you know, if the child's in pain, sore stomach.
Pain I see here is the two index fingers kind of going towards each other in front of the child's chest and putting her two index fingers together.
Once they've accepted the concept of the fact that you're doing a sign to them every time you do an action, once they've accepted that and the simple signs, which would be eat more milk, etc., more water, you then can move on to other signs after that. So pain would be taught either through the use of the fact that the child is teething. You can teach them, you know, that they've got pain in their mouth, they're sore, so you do the pain sign and point to the mouth.
So you're saying you would use incidents that the child already has, like a sore gum, to teach the sign pain in the hopes that the child might use that if they come down with flu-like symptoms?
Yes, this is exactly it. It's teaching through association, you know, which is why it needs to be taught now, so that children, small children and babies are able to communicate in this way as well before they can speak.
What do you say to people who say, you know, with the swine flu, a serious topic, it's parents who should detect symptoms, and you should know if your child is feverish or isn't feeling well and not have to wait for signs. And, you know, this general criticism of baby sign language, that it overburdens a child. There's already criticism of, you know, even the tapes that are supposed to make them smarter, that there's a reason that children are supposed to progress at a certain pace, and that this idea of teaching them signs at 5 months might overburden their circuitry.
Well, apparently, you know, from all the research that's been done so far, it has been noticed that it actually reduces the frustration of the child, because they feel they're able to communicate and they feel they're getting sympathy, or, you know, they're being accepted. And I would say parents, yes, should take the responsibility first thing. Take temperature right away. You know, that's a big thing with swine flu, is the temperature goes up right away. And if they've got any doubt whatsoever, they should really be phoning, you know, a medic or a doctor or whatever their government is expecting them to do. The whole point about highlighting the swine flu signs is to let everyone know that there is this other way that your child can communicate to you before speech, and even after speech. A lot of children use it if they struggle with a word.
That's Yvonne Lavelle. She recently wrote an online edition to her book, Baby and Toddler Signing, and the online edition relates to swine flu-related sign language for babies and infants. We'll have much more information on our website, herenow.org. Yvonne, thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you very much.
And we have this follow-up to a story we covered on Here and Now. Last week, we noted the unveiling of the Nissan Leaf, Nissan's all-electric car coming to showrooms next fall. Not to be outdone, today General Motors announced that its new Chevy Volt rechargeable electric car should get a whopping 230 miles to the gallon in city driving. That's more than four times the mileage of the popular Toyota Prius. Here's Fritz Henderson, General Motors CEO.
Since three-quarters of Americans commute fewer than 40 miles a day, most Volt drivers will operate on a daily basis without having to use a single drop of gas.
If the figure is confirmed by the Environmental Protection Agency, the Volt will be the first ever vehicle to exceed triple-digit gas mileage. So far, the company has produced 30 of the cars and will continue to make about 10 a week. How much does it cost to charge the vehicle? Henderson said about 40 cents a day. The car is due in the showroom in 2010 and is expected to cost about $40,000. Well, before we go today, the Yoga Warriors, Vietnam-era veterans, hitting the mat to do savasanas. You're listening to Here and Now. Welcome back.
Take a breath in and we'll chant the sound of Om.
In a candlelit room in West Boylston, Massachusetts, 8 men sit cross-legged on purple foam mats, carefully listening to instructor Lucy Cimini as she walks them through a series of yoga postures.
Take the right leg straight out. Press into your left shin. Make sure everything is pretty firm. Right arm, left shin. And then when you're ready, lift that left arm up.
The men are all in their 60s. Some are slim, fit. They easily handle the maneuvers. Others struggle to keep their balance during the more demanding poses.
Turn your pelvis towards the floor, okay? When you're ready, lift out your right arm.
They're a disparate group, but they have one thing in common. They're all veterans of the Vietnam War. They all suffer from PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and they all believe that yoga is helping them cope with their symptoms.
Squeeze in affirmation, I forgive myself. I forgive myself. I forgive myself. I forgive myself.
Lucy Cimini created her pioneering program at her Central Massachusetts Yoga Institute 4 years ago. We're joined now by two of her yoga warriors. Tom Boyle is from Belmont, Massachusetts. He works as a readjustment counselor at the Worcester Veterans Center. He's been a yoga warrior for about 4 years. Tom, welcome.
Thank you.
And Paul Gary joins us as well. He's from Rutland, Mass. He started yoga about 4 months ago. Paul, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
And both of you saw combat in Vietnam, served separately in the Army's 25th Infantry Division. Tom, let's start with you. What brought you to yoga?
I tried it myself several years ago. I didn't know much about it, but I enjoyed it. But one of my veterans said he had started a yoga class, and it was helping him with his anger. And before I knew it, we had 8, 9 vets that were started to come to the yoga classes, and they've been coming ever since.
And what's happened to them? What have you seen?
What I've seen with the vets, and they will report this willingly, their PTSD symptoms get diminished. I've got vets who are sleeping now and don't require medication as a result of their yoga practice.
Well, I want to talk to Paul Gary about that. Paul, we understand you started receiving treatment for PTSD about, what, 4 months ago?
That's about right, yeah.
Well, so you had gone since what, the early 70s, late 60s?
I got out I was in Vietnam in 1969.
Well, help us understand, what were the feelings that you've had for the last couple of decades? And again, diagnosed as PTSD, but what were they? What are they?
You're angry basically all the time. A lot of people try to self-medicate, which I did. You wake up at night from nightmares, from bad dreams. A lot of times it's the same thing over and over again. Right now I have to take basically some mood pills to keep, you know, to try to keep me calm. And plus with the yoga, it's actually also working. But the big key is I have 3 daughters. Youngest one is 28. When they come up on a Sunday, will turn around and tell me they see a big difference in Dad.
Well, tell us about that. Apparently, you've had a big change. Can you put it into words what it feels like to get into the room, to take off your shoes, to, you know, go into the downward-facing dog, the big upside-down V?
Yep.
What does it feel like?
When I'm doing the downward dog there, I have a hard time holding myself up. But you're focusing on something else while you're actually, you know, you're stretching and strengthening your muscles. You have a focal point. You might be breathing a little bit heavy, but the actual muscles that you're using, and whether it's stretching or doing a position in the warrior or anything like that, you actually get to feel, it's like a little high, actually.
Huh.
So when you walk out of here, you feel like a new person, and you look forward to coming back.
Well, there's research that shows that yoga breathing techniques, meditations, postures stimulate the parasympathetic nervous system and can slow heart rates, relax muscles, basically calm you down, and reduce the constant flight or fight mode we understand as a symptom of PTSD. And Paul, you mentioned another symptom, which is anger. We understand there's a yoga movement your class does specifically designed to relieve some of that.
Well, yeah, because we do what's called a put our hands over our head and like wood chopper. And we'll do that for quite a bit, and we yell when we're actually down below hitting the make-believe wood, and we blow the roof off the building.
Well, in fact, we recorded some sound of you yoga warriors doing the wood chopper move. It's mantra, I release anger with an open heart. Let's listen.
Bring your arms up and back. I'm going to release that anger.
Ha! 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 Ha!
Well, this has a spiritual component, too, in some ways. And I'm wondering, you mentioned the warrior. This is, there are different warrior positions. The most familiar to people probably is sort of like a swordsman's thrust. Your front leg bent, your back leg extended, both right. arms extended out. It's the warrior position.
Yep.
What's it like when you look around the room and you are all warriors?
We're just all friends because I know how he feels. He knows how I feel. Been through the same thing, and we don't talk about past things. Everything we talk about is how to move forward from here, how to let go, get rid of all the negative thinking, which is a big part of my problem. I was pretty negative about everything. And my family, again, I have to say that they didn't like me very much when we were younger, but they noticed a big difference in me lately since coming here for yoga.
Well, that's Paul Gary. Tom Boyle, back to you, a readjustment counselor at the Worcester Veterans Center, as well as a yoga warrior. I understand you've seen about 80 vets come through, mostly Vietnam vets. How are vets reacting to yoga warriors? Are they as enthusiastic as Paul? And are the younger Iraq War vets able to take advantage of it?
It's offered to them, but only a few have tried it. The Iraqi vets they're so busy trying to resettle their lives, you know, getting jobs or going to school or dealing with marriage issues and stuff like that. They're not in a stable place.
Well, I'm wondering if those that don't come to Yoga Warriors maybe don't come because they are afraid that it might soften them when in fact, well, what would you say it would do for them?
Oh, I think it would strengthen them. I think it would make them better soldiers because of the ability to focus and be mindful. That's a very important thing for a soldier to be. He has to be present, and yoga helps with that.
And we understand, too, Tom, that since the Afghan and Iraq wars, there have been a lot of Vietnam vets who've come to see you and maybe even gone on into Yoga Warriors because it's triggered PTSD.
Yes. I picked up 3 vets in the past 2 weeks who were 40 years since Vietnam, and they had not done any kind of counseling or treatment.
And what did they say about it being triggered to an extent now where they had to have help?
A lot of Vietnam vets, you know, we learned how to cope, maybe not necessarily the best way, but we made our adjustments. But all of a sudden, when this war broke out, it's Vietnam all over again.
That's Tom Boyle, a readjustment counselor at the Worcester Veterans Center here in Massachusetts and also one of the yoga warriors. Paul Gary from Rutland, Mass., also a veteran and has been a yoga warrior for about 4 months now. Namaste to you both.
Okay. Thank you.
Namaste to you.